In a few moments, minutes, not hours, we're going to eat the Lord's Supper. We're going to eat bread. We're going to drink the cup. We think the hours of agony and suffering and pain. And we think of the victory that we have through that sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. That means so much to us. We do that with great understanding, with fellowship, one with another, and with Jesus Christ. And yet, you get beyond such assemblies as this today, and it means very little to other people. In Lamentations, there is a picture of Jerusalem under siege and at waste, in the death throes of its struggle for existence. And Jeremiah says, "Is it nothing to you all that passed by?" He looked at the rest of the world and the enemies of Jerusalem, and they would gladly simply sit by and let it perish, the city where the house of God had been built, where its kings had reigned, and now in destruction. And he said, "Is it nothing to you, all that passed by?" Why is it that this Lord's Supper means so much to us? And yet there are people out there who know nothing about it. They do not even know. It is hard to understand that in the past so many people at least knew what we were doing here. And now there are people who have no idea that we come together, we eat bread and we drink the cup. I guess they're much like the ancient Roman world who heard about eating flesh and drinking blood, so that they thought those early Christians were actually cannibals and engaging in such activity. But I'm going to look at some passages for a moment which will help us understand the difference between faith and between what the rest of the world is occupied with today. And actually, the things that Scott said really lead into this. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see, they shall perceive, they shall know God. Who? The pure in heart. That's a challenge to us, as Scott set forth. The responsibilities we have if we have a pure heart, and the responsibilities we will engage in if we have a pure heart. But what makes this difference? Let's begin our study in the book of John in the 9th chapter. Jesus has healed the man born blind, and the chief priest in the synagogue cast him out because he will not renounce Jesus, who has healed him and given him his sight. And Jesus finds him again and said, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" And he said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe? Who is he, sir, that I may believe?" And Jesus said, "He it is who speaks unto you." That brings us then to the verses that I want to consider in John, the 9th chapter, and I've turned to the wrong page. And I want us to start reading in verse 35, John 9, 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and finding him, said, "Dost thou believe on the Son of God?" And he answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe on him?" Jesus said unto him, "You have both seen him, and it is he that speaks with you." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. And Jesus said, "For judgment came I into the world, that they that see may not see. I came to judge certain ones, so that those who see may not see, and that they that see may become blind." Let me read that again and make sure I got that right. And Jesus said, "For judgment came I into the world, that they that see not." All right, I knew I felt like I did something wrong there. "So that they that see not may see, and they that see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who went with him heard these things and said unto him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said unto them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, we see, and your sin remains with you. The idea is this. There are people in Scott's lesson whose hearts are not pure. They're clouded. They are crowded with other things. They are concerned with other things. And there are those who put their faith in their own intelligence and their own cleverness and their own accomplishments and all of their own aspirations. Those are the things they see. Those are the things they are occupied with in life. And those who see all of these things and those who see their own ability to solve every problem in life and give answers that suit them and let them live the way they want to, those who see that don't see Christ because their hearts are not pure. And then there are others who say, I do not have the answers. Everything that I can discern or think about does not satisfy, does not lead to the answers that I need to know. I am blind. And they seek and they search and their hearts are pure and they find. And that challenges each one of us then, as Scott challenged us, to discern and see the kind of hearts that we particularly have. But what are people looking at? There's a paradox there. There are people in life who are down and out. They're in distress. They know one woe after another. It seems that the problems of life just will not end. When they think they've got one thing solved, another comes along and bothers them. And they seek and they search. And they turn to God and they find peace and they find hope and at least whatever they have or don't have in this life, they're going to have glory after a while. On the other hand, of course, I do know that there are people who in their troubles want to blame God. It's all his fault. But the reason they decide that is because there's something else clouding their heart. But then we have people who everything is going fine. Their condition of life is certainly palpable to give them in giving them pleasure, a pleasure they can actually feel. And they're so occupied with that, they are blinded to their need, they are blinded to the truth of God, they are blinded to their responsibility of God. And so they think they see. I am so intelligent, I am so brilliant, I can figure all of this out, I'm satisfied with that, and here's the truth on the other side, and they do not see that. So in this paradox, where you have people who are without and struggling, and they have reason to have sorrow for themselves, and they see and they live and they have hope. On the other hand, there are those who have everything in the world to rejoice in, and they are empty, and they are without hope. And according to the passage we're reading here, and the idea is that they do not see. To answer that, and to look at that paradox and why people come to such different conclusions, we're going to find it has nothing to do with intelligence. They're brilliant people who have believed in God. Sir Isaac Newton, one of the brilliant men who've lived upon the face of this earth, and he is so accounted, believes strongly in God. Whether you believe in God or not doesn't matter or isn't determined by whether you have 180 IQ or 100 IQ. It has to do with what you are and what is important to you. And that's the thing I want us to read in this particular text. Jesus has gone into a synagogue on the Sabbath, and he sees a man there with a withered arm. And the idea in the word actually conveys the idea that it is one that has been injured, and it has become useless. And in its uselessness, the muscle elasticity is gone, and he cannot use it. It's obvious that he has an affliction. And so seeing them, he comes to the challenge of what he shall do about that. And so I want us to start then reading in Mark, the third chapter, and verse 1. And he entered into the synagogue, and there was a man there with his hand withered, and they watched him whether he would heal him on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him. They had seen Jesus work signs. They had seen him do things on the Sabbath. He violated their concept of the Sabbath, which was not God's concept of the Sabbath. It was their concept of the Sabbath. And with this man there, with this affliction, and Jesus there, they're thinking, ah, he is going to heal that man, and he's going to break the Sabbath, and we're going to prove him to be a sinner. And he said unto the man that had his hand withered, stand forth. He has him stand forth so that people can see who are not aware they know what condition he's in. And when he heals the man, they will see visibly what he has done. And he said unto him, is it lawful on the Sabbath day to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill? But they held the peace. And when he had looked about on them around with anger, that's surprising, isn't it? Jesus looks at them and he sees what's in their heart. And he sees the challenge they are setting forth for God himself and for the Son of God in the hardness of their heart. And he knew their plot and their plan. And he looked at them as this man stood there in need. And they're not concerned with the man. They're not concerned with his plight. They're not concerned with truth. They're concerned with one thing, getting him to violate the commandment of God, as they perceive the commandment of God wrongly, as it turns out, that they might accuse him. And when he had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved at the hardening of their, heart, he said unto the man, stretch forth your hand. And he stretched it forth, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and straightway with the Herodians took counsel against him that they might destroy him. This good thing this man did, what made the difference? Was it their intelligence? Was it because they were more brilliant than the rest? No, it was the condition of their heart. It was what they were really concerned with in life. It was what was important to them. And what was important to them, there was their own particular condition in life. Same thing happened over in John the 11th chapter with the healing of Lazarus. Lazarus is, well, healing indeed. When he is dead and he is in the grave now, the fourth day, and Jesus said, Lazarus, come forth, and he comes forth. And when the chief priests and the Pharisees saw that, they admitted that he did many signs and they must destroy him. And their concern was, lest the Romans come and take away our place and destroy our nation. What were they concerned with? What were they concerned with? Our place. We are the chief priests. We priests. We are in charge here. We have these people giving to us devotion. We have religion set up the way we want it. We have life set up the way we want it. This man is going to upset. That was their concern. Not because they were more brilliant, but because that was their concern. And then later, as Lazarus continues to live and Jesus continues to abide there, with Mary and Martha and Lazarus, people are coming out to see Lazarus and they are believing. So what do the chief priests do? They say, we've got to kill Lazarus. They knew Lazarus lived. They knew Lazarus had been dead. There was no way to dispute that. And so, yet so hard were their hearts that the truth meant nothing to them. The evidence meant nothing to them. They didn't sit back and evaluate and say, what does this mean? It meant to them, this is going to cause turmoil. The Romans are going to come in, and the wonderful place we are sitting in now, the power that we have, all of that is going to be taken from us. We started off, why do some believe and why do some not? It's what's in their heart. It's what is important to them. And these people were concerned with their physical condition in life and the power they had and the influence they have and the standing that they had. It didn't matter that a man had been raised from the dead and that this man did it, attesting to the fact that he was a man of God, as Nicodemus recognized when he came to Jesus in John, the third chapter. And that brings us to Christ on the cross in Luke, the 23rd chapter. And we know the scene. He was crucified about 9 o'clock. About 12 o'clock, the sun was darkened, and there was a great darkness. And there was a tremendous earthquake. Graves were opened. And those that stood by were terrified at the things that they saw. And so let's begin our reading then over here in the book of Matthew. And I want to start reading in verses 26. Or no, let me start reading in Luke, the 23rd chapter and verse 44 with this. And it was now about the sixth hour, and darkness came over the whole of the land until the ninth hour. The sun's light failing, and the veil of the temple was rent in its midst. That was not an insignificant thing. Behind that veil, nobody went except the high priest. And he went once a year to take the blood of the atonement and pour it upon the mercy seat. And he stayed long enough just to do that. That was behind the temple. That was such a holy place. And now the temple is rent. And of course, now you know the significance of that. That whole setup in the Old Testament was separation. Here is God, here is his holiness, and there you are, and you are separated from it. He made provision to forgive them, but upon the basis of what he was going to do, and with the rending of that veil, God is now accessible. He's not accessible just to the Jew, he is acceptable to all. What I'm saying is that was a significant thing that happened. We saw the earthquake, that's significant, and the darkness, and that is significant, but it was significant that that veil was rent. And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, "Father, into thy hands I command my spirit." And having said this, he gave up the ghost. And when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, "Certainly this was a righteous man." And he also said, according to Matthew, "Surely this was the Son of God." And all the multitude that came to behold the things that were done returned smiting their breasts. And all his acquaintances and all the women that followed with him from Galilee stood far off, seeing these things. The angst of the people as they witnessed the darkness, the earthquake, the rending of the veil in the temple, and the last words, Jesus, and they smite their breasts and leave and go back into the city. As someone observed, the magnet of the death and the cross of Christ began to work at that moment, changing hearts, but not changing all of the hearts. After Jesus now has died, there are those who feel perfectly happy with that. And they've got him buried in a tomb, and then the chief priests, again, and the Pharisees go to Pilate, and they say, "This man said, while he was yet alive, 'After 3 days I rise again, give us a guard and prevent the disciples from coming and taking him and the people believing that that is so.'" You know, you see their dishonesty there. When they put Jesus on trial, this passage where Jesus said, "After 3 days I will rise again," they accused him of saying that was the temple that he would build again. And that's blasphemy. Took Herod 40 years to build that thing out there and to improve it and bring it to its status. And he says he's going to build it in 3 days. Heresy, heresy, convict him. That's the evidence that they use to say he has committed blasphemy. He is worthy of death. But they knew what he meant. They got the point. Because now they go to Herod and say, "You know, he said after 3 days he would rise again." So Herod gives them a guard. I think when I was a child, I figured Roman guard standing out, this shield, he's got his sword, and he's standing there, and these things take place, and he gets frightened. No, it's a company of soldiers. And we're going to find, after what happens, that happens, some of them go into the city, and some remain there. And looking at the text, it looks as if they remained there all through the time that the women came and left. I don't think they were standing right there by the tomb, this whole company of soldiers. And they are pictured as standing off and trembling because an angel came down from heaven and his appearance was as lightning. And he rolled away the stone and then he comes out and sits on the stone. I suppose Jesus walks out. I don't know that, but it appears from everything we see. The women come and they don't find Jesus, but they find the empty tomb. There is the announcement he has risen. And then some of the soldiers go into the city. There they stand, a company of Roman soldiers. They're going to keep those disciples from coming and rolling away the tomb and taking the body. And they are trembling at what they see. And they see the stone rolled away. They're witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the people in the city, those officers, the chief priests and the Pharisees, again said, or the soldiers said, according to the text, "All things that were come to pass, they told." All things. They saw everything that came to pass. They told the chief priests, "This is what happened. We were there. We had our spears. We had our shields. We had our swords. We were ready." I don't know that they emphasized the fact that they stood there trembling and became as dead men. I don't think that means they became catatonic. They became immobilized. And in the face of the angel of God, and in the face of the resurrection of the Son of God, there they stood, trembling, totally immobilized, unable to do anything until it was over. Then they went and they told the chief priest, that's what happened. What did the chief priest say? You know, maybe we were wrong. I mean, if he's been raised from the dead, maybe we ought to pay some attention to that. No. What they said was, we're going to give you much money, and you tell everybody that while you slept, which would have been a cause for their own death, the disciples came and took him away, and they gave them much money. And that's the story that was spread. One curious thing there before we close these thoughts. There's a document that was found, I suppose in the 1960s or 1970s. I can't remember when I bought this particular book, but it's a book that had been written earlier by Pfeiffer. And the Roman emperor, after this resurrection of Jesus, sent an order to Palestine saying, if anybody robs a body from the grave, the death penalty is to be imposed. Why in the world is the Roman emperor over there concerned so much about people robbing graves and taking bodies from graves? The word of the soldiers had gotten all the way back to Rome. And to settle that, and because of the turmoil and all the things that were going on in Galilee and people believing, he said, we've got to stop this grave robbing. But that's evidence that the tomb was found empty, and it remains empty to this day, and thus we celebrate that by eating the Lord's Supper. We have a background of promises, of foreshadows and ceremonies, of specific prophecies, and testimony of men who went to death saying, we witnessed these things. He is the Son of God. You know, you might get 12 people on a plot, but surely, with all of them, in effect, having a pistol placed to their head, I'm getting ahead of time, it would be a sword to their neck, and say, renounce this or you're going to die, most likely some of them are going to cave, but none did. All these 12 men died saying, we saw him raised from the dead. And we're going to eat the Lord's Supper. And in that, we're going to join Christians around the world today who are doing that very same thing on this very same day. Sadly, there are other people who claim to be Christians, and that's just too much for them to do, to eat the bread and drink the cup. But Jesus said, this do in remembrance of me. And we're going to do that as we eat the Lord's Supper.